corporate tax by being able to purchase without paying their fair share of the burden, by holding stocks and bonds and not needing to report it, by getting involved in industries at all levels and not needing to report any of this, and the powerful way that they move in. Look what the Baptists do to Texas. You know, I couldn't even have a mixed drink on the show, despite the fact that I've got the flu tonight. This is horrible. And if you stop and look at this, women all over the United States can't do anything about abortion, simply because of the Roman Catholic Church. Young men can't do anything in relationship to the draft, simply because they have to be a conscientious objector and believe in God before they can say, I don't want to be drafted. There are all kind of inequities in regard to this. And it's very serious.
You want to be in on it.
What we're saying is this. We are going to show you this. We are going to make this dishonesty ring throughout the land so that everybody will see it and hear it.
If there is a dishonesty, would you be honest in partaking of the dishonesty and expect these young people who are at the point of life where they want to make a decision, you expect them to follow someone who is following the dishonest part of Christianity?
I am going to associate myself with the money.
Thank you.
And with that money, I'm going to say to the young people, all right, we'll show you then that we can get a seminary, and you can join the seminary, and you too can be draft exempt.
There's something I've been wanting to ask Dr. Bauman. I wonder if I might now. I'm curious about who you think is winning right now in the country. Are we becoming more or less religious in the United States now?
Well, once again, we get into this old semantic problem.
Since everybody is religious, you're not losing.
Yeah, exactly. There'd be another whole way of coming at it that I think would be very meaningful, especially on a college campus setting, and that's the fact that religion is being very definitely secularized, that the understanding of who, how, where, and when God is acting is more fully identified with the issues of our time, the kind of life we're living in our world today, the very things that Mrs. O'Hara is concerned about, and the fact that religion is becoming aware, religionists are becoming aware of this need to understand God's action in the world as it is, it seems to me is a very definite sign of progress for religion. Now, if we revert to Mrs. O'Hare's continuous definition of religion in terms of certain externals, such as the form of worship or the institution itself and its tax dodges and so on, then the question is up for grabs, I can't say. But as far as religion in essence is concerned, I'm positively convinced that it's gaining in a creative and constructive way, and that we're getting away from many of the very stereotypes that both she and I are so deeply concerned about, which I simply happen to believe are misinterpretations of the Judeo-Christian tradition.
I guess the question was whether it's dying or not.
Well, but what do you mean by it? If you mean the institution, the smell of death is everywhere, and I think that's the work of God himself, who's going to kill it off and renew it. If you mean religion itself or God himself, then obviously not, as I've already stated.
Mm-hmm. Pretty soon you'll move to the position of atheism and you'll be calling it Methodism. Let me ask you a question. There are 11 million Methodists, more or less, in the United States. I hear various statistics because you all report in a very funny way.
Yeah, so do the atheists.
If those 11... We don't have an opportunity to report. If those 11 million Methodists would all contact President Nixon tomorrow and say we would like to withdraw from the war in Vietnam, would we be able to do it?
How many?
If those 11 million Methodists, remember, you're organized. You have grassroots in every city. You have money. You have a voice. You have a voice on television, radio, and newspapers. You have it in the pulpit. You are the grassroots organization in America. Now, if every one of those 11 million Methodists would say tomorrow, this is enough of this now. From here on, the Negro is integrated. Would he be integrated?
How many atheists do you suppose there are in America?
It's impossible to tell, simply because there are no statistics in relationship to
you don't have any idea at all.
We have some fairly decent ideas in respect to sociology, studies in various universities, etc. And it's very, very difficult for this reason. I will go into the peace movement, and I will find there, sitting in a Methodist church or a Unitarian church or a Roman Catholic church, half of our membership in that particular city. And as far as anybody in the audience will know, those persons are either Methodists or Roman Catholics, etc., working for peace.
Then there must be at least 12 million atheists in the country. I mean, at least.
And if any one of them speaks up, the same thing happens to them that happens to me, doesn't it?
No, all I'm going to ask you is, can you get the 12 million atheists to agree on anything?
Providing I get a voice to speak to them, yes.
Well, this is a...
I gather you don't have that authority.
This is a sign of supreme human confidence. It seems to me that if you speak, 12 million people will agree with what you're saying.
What I'm saying is this. We are unable to contact those persons who are with us in respect to religion. We are consistently unable to contact them.
But I'm still interested. If you could contact them, are you telling me that you could persuade them to follow your particular point of view on anything?
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that for instance, if I could pose a problem to them in relationship to religion, I know what they would say in relationship to that particular thing. For instance, the continuing use of Bible and prayer in the public schools. I think that there would be no argument on that. The necessity for separation of church and state. I think that there would be no argument in relationship to that from the atheist community. I think that we would be almost monolithic in certain areas.
Yeah.
In certain other areas, we would be not. Because, for instance, atheists are found most in the Republican Party in America.
You have answered my question. On certain questions, the 12 million Methodists would be primarily monolithic. There are certain issues we would agree on.
Jesus Christ is the Prince of Peace.
But an issue such as a specific law in a specific time, one of the problems that Christians have is that Christ's only absolute teaching was the law of love, absolute agape love.
And we're really whaling them with love over in Vietnam.
And what this means in a specific situation, you will never get 12 million Christians to agree on. This is part of the problem that we have. What does it mean to love
it's
in a specific situation?
It's also called a
cop-out.
Let's get back out into the audience. This gentleman
sees here quail.
Sir?
They used to raise quail down there.
I believe it was a widow woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know who you mean. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, Billy.
I'd like to get that, and you know, if I could get it right, I don't want to say it. You know, I want a deal like you got.
If I'd have known you was wanting one out there, over there, two lots from me.
Yeah.
Fellow in at work here bought one for $3,000.
Yeah.
Of course, it don't have no house or anything on it, but.
Well, this one doesn't either.
No, I know that's got that. Oh, it's got that old trailer on down there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That old trailer ain't worth burning.
No, I know it's not. Uh-uh.
So I figured it might could be bought reasonable. I could go over there and clean it up, put me something on it, you know.
Oh yeah, sure, man. Well, I can find out for you, Billy.
Would you do it?
Yeah, sure will, buddy.
I sure would appreciate it.
No, sir, we'll find out for you. And if we can't get nothing out there on that business, why, I'll look for something else right there. If you want something.
All
right. So I will for you.
Man, I would appreciate it.
Listen, go ahead and sell that truck, Bill.
Okay.
Because Mom, she's getting on that man in there where she's working at. He's trying to give her a hard time.
Yeah.
And looks like they're going to close up in there, so.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take too much on myself to handle, you know.
No, sorry, man. I don't blame you.
So I don't. So you go ahead, Billy, and we'll... just a minute. Just hang on just a second.
Hey, hon. You know who owns that, down there, with that old trailer on that house down on the ground down there? Where, no, down out the lake where they raised them quail. What was that people's name?
Gambert's was the place down there.
Huh?
Gambert was the place down there. Used to own it. place you're talking about.
Gambert?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to find out. I'm going out Saturday, and I'll find out, Billy, for sure.
Find out all about it and how we can get in touch.
I sure will. All right, Billy.
Sure, thank you.
Here. Okay, old buddy, and thank you to... Hey, Bill.
Uh-huh.
Listen, how about... Are you going to have anything for a truck or anything I can get for Saturday?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Will you mind bringing me one up?
Not a bit in the world.
Okay, buddy.
All
I know.
Right.
I'll be seeing you then.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Billy.
Good night.
Somewhat inconsistent. Very briefly, the problem is small and well-run prisons and large and bad, poorly-run prisons, and where young first offenders are not segregated from older inmates. Now, as you may know, the concept of conjugal visiting and furloughs for married prisoners has long been used in a great number of foreign countries, notably Mexico, with many authorities convinced that the practice does cut down on homosexuality. The use of furloughs and conjugal visiting is increasing in our prison system. For example, it's been in use for some time at the state penitentiary in Parchment, Mississippi. And recently, in February, the state of California decided to go ahead with family visiting in all its correctional institutions. Now, here it's important to understand the implication of the words family visiting. The concept is broader than conjugal.
This is a family, father, mother, and small son, and they're relaxed in a typical home setting. Great care has been taken to make it seem like a home, especially to the father. He is a prison inmate, and the home-like atmosphere he enjoys is in one of two furnished cottages just outside the security perimeter of California's Tehachapi Prison, where the state first experimented with family visiting.
Now, the experiment here has helped change the attitude of the men. Some men aren't eligible to go out there, but they say they'll defend as to their dying death the other people's right to go.
Superintendent Perry Lloyd, who views the program as an important step toward social integration.
I've talked to a good many wives, and it has helped ease their feelings. In fact, I'm sure it's kept a lot of marriages together. Too often we have to release people that have no one to go to. And they have a very difficult adjustment. Here they have they're busy 16 hours a day. They have their friends in the institution. And to go out in the cold world where they know no one, well, it's a pretty difficult situation.
Mr. Correa, is this the first time you and your wife have been able to use this facility?
No, it's been the third.
What do you think of it? How's it working out?
Well, it's helping me and my wife. If our marriage is keeping it together, I have an opportunity to be with her and the kids.
What's the problem with maintaining marriage generally when you're in prison?
Well, the communication, I guess, would be the major thing, being away from your wife and your kids. Only seeing them in visits, you know, whenever they come up, Saturdays or Sundays. It's hard to maintain a relationship, you know, in that manner.
We were each other now at school?
We were at school, yes.
What do you talk about generally at a time like this when you meet each other?
You mean your wife?
Yeah.
Well, it's a good day. Usually about the kids, how they're doing in school, about her, how she's getting along, the bills, well, everything, probably just about everything.
You get to meet a few problems that you hear about?
Well, she has all the problems. I've got problems too, and I'm getting out of it, but I think she carries the majority of them.
Mm-hmm. This is a lot of you worried, isn't it?
Well, having her come up here and being with me for these 2 days, it helps me, it helps her. Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the visit to school?
It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice.
You look forward to it?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I get butterflies for one thing.
Yeah, how do you know?
When I come up there.
You get butterflies? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in my stomach. I get shook up. Because we don't see very often, you know, we're together like this. just been visiting, but that's not the same as being here together.
Mm-hmm. How do the children react to it when they come up?
They go wild.
Mm-hmm. Helps them a little bit, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I come and tell them to scold them for them. And tell them something, you know, so when they get along, they remember what he says.
Mm-hmm.
But they just forget it. The minute they walk out the gate.
Mm-hmm. Makes a difference, Mr. Carrillo, in seeing the children grow up.
Well, it helps. It's hard, it's difficult for the kids and the wife and the husband to be separated. And this is an opportunity to bring them together, to keep a close relationship. It definitely helps.
When I first came to this institution, when I first was arrested, I was thinking of divorcing my wife. And she said no. She wanted to go through the whole thing, you know. And I went along with her. I told her, you know, I think if you think you can wait, it's going to be a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I know I can wait.
Mm-hmm. It's important, I guess, seeing your son like this.
Very important. Very important, because it's been quite a while since I've seen him. I have a little daughter also, Dina Jean, and I haven't seen her yet because she's too small
mm-hmm.
to travel, you know. So that's one reason.
What kind of plans do you have when you get out?
Stay united with my family and work hard. I have two or three jobs that I've been offered, but one especially is the one in maintenance. I have a letter of recommendation for this job as soon as I'm released.
Family makes a difference then when you're released, huh?
Not a difference. Not a difference.
Tehachapi has a prison industries program, but as another means of preparing men for the outside, the institution teaches, along with academic subjects, 16 separate trades. The silk screen process, for example, one of the few places in the entire state one can learn it. Products like these flags are sold to other state institutions. About half the inmates are involved in academic or vocational training, and each man is scheduled for a full 8-hour day. There's welding, auto mechanics, sewing machine repair, and one official spends all his time finding jobs for men being released. Open dormitories sometimes surprise men transferred here from other prisons.
We have people transferred in here from maximum security places that don't even stay here when the sun goes down. And we can't stand that open dormitory. Just can't stand the open dormitory, the feeling of freedom. Some of them have committed some crimes that they're ashamed of, and even though they'd hate to admit it, some of these things bother them. And if we can strip away the things that they can hate,
like bars,
and lockup, for those that can take this kind of treatment, they have nothing to hate but themselves.
But if you can take it, if you can learn to accept this openness and get rid of some of the hatred that he feels for the system, what happens to him?
Well, I believe he has a better chance to look deeply inside and find out why he did the things that he did, why he had to go out every Saturday night and get drunk and leave his wife and kids at home, or why he had to get drunk and beat his wife up every Saturday night, he had a chance. So some of these things bother him, and if he has to stay over here and think about it, we'd much rather he'd be thinking about those things than to thinking about how terrible the state treats him or how terrible things are in the institution.
Sure, we have to
just change his attitude completely if we can.
Two things I think are noteworthy here, Hugh. One is that a man is removed from society for a crime, protecting society. He's punished by being removed from society, but he's also taught a trade. He learns how to, in a sense, have the knack of getting along with society. The other thing is that this family visiting is not just a means for providing a heterosexual escape, but it does have values with regard to combating homosexuality. So we're learning.
Could you compare this to the progress we've made, and we're still a long way to go, but in our approach to mental hospitals?
Yes, I talked with Dr. Carl Menninger about that, a psychiatrist and chairman of the Menninger Foundation. And when I talked...
They were obviously sick and innocent of any offense or great offense. Here we were treating them very cruelly. We began to wake up to the fact that there's a better way to do this. We can get these people out of this confinement. We can do something to get them back on the track. We can restore them. We want them back. We love them. We need them. And that reform in the state hospitals came easier once the public knew the facts.
In other words, one might not be able to hope for that speed in changing prison systems. There isn't that kind of pity for inmates.
That's right. The public feels a little bit as if it had already been offended by the offender. There's a little resentment of that. There's a little fear, as a matter of fact, too.
How much basis is there to the fear of the offender, the inmate, the man who's locked away? How much basis is there?
Well, you know how it is. In part, this is one of these great catastrophes of words, the wrong word getting attached. See, when you say criminal, the average person thinks violent man, murderer, rapist, robber, so on. And yet, actually, this word criminal covers a large number of people who haven't done any such violent acts. It's hard to visualize the fact that I say criminal, it rings a bell. When I say crime, criminal, it rings a bell. People are alerted. You hear, he's a dangerous man. If I say that man's a criminal, I look at him, look at his muscles and so forth. And yet 80% of the prisoners in the penitentiaries and jails of this country, you haven't done anything. Or haven't done anything violent.
Like a check forger?
Oh, sure. They've cheated and they've broken the rules and they've stolen and so forth. They haven't hurt anybody. Some guy except themselves. Many people are in jail and prison today only because they hurt themselves. Now, suicide is the only crime that you're exonerated of if you're successful. I mean, the attempt to destroy yourself is in some way or other, is considered a crime.
Very interesting. Yes. Yes, when you think of it that way, that the word crime rings a bell.
It's a trigger word.
So many people still think, though, that any of these efforts at reform, which will ultimately have some social benefit, even if you subtract the humane aspect, but this is coddling criminals. That phrase keeps coming up.
Yes.
And how do you deal with that? Well, you've just got to try to tell them, as Dr. Menninger has, that you can cut down on the repeaters. These are the people that, if you like to use the word crime, cause the crime. That's the sort of thing. If you can work with them, but just to lock them away and let them out again, where they cannot cope with society, made it for different reasons, you're not solving it. You're just providing more crime for yourself unless you put that effort into the prisons.
If a prisoner were it's necessary to lock somebody up because it's clear that he would untreated to break his environment again if he got out, if he were kept under surveillance, but suppose a continual family situation was allowed, and he was allowed to work at something under surveillance that would give the money to keep his family intact, would this in your mind be workable?
At least to the extent of amplifying what we have now called halfway houses, in which a man is let out to in kind of parole, probation, and he lives at a halfway house and progresses from there to, in the work release program perhaps, to society, which incidentally is something we're talking about tomorrow. I have a forum.
Tomorrow finishes up for us a series. Sit tight for me to call to go to meet a keynote friend who's going to help me with a commercial message. Be right back. Time is 56 minutes after the hour. And we'll meet Cobble here.
Hey, Cobble, don't worry. We haven't done the commercial yet.
Stick around. Stay with me. We'll do the commercial. We'll get some alpha. This is a fellow who has a way down to earth method for deciding what he likes. And he's very temperamental, too. Now, where is it? Did he eat it already? Well, there it is. No, he didn't get at it yet. Here, a nutrition expert, if you were, he might tell you that the reason he eats alpha is because it provides him with 100% of the vitamins and minerals he needs. But takes his good health for granted. He doesn't know a vitamin from a mineral, I'm sure, but he knows alpha. And I think we're going to give him some now because he's waited long enough. He's been very patient. Kyle, the real one was here the other time, and I thought you were... Boy, you're going to do well in this commercial, aren't you?
The agents of the SST kept repeating one challenge. If the supersonic transport is so desirable, they said, it should be possible to get banks to finance it rather than the taxpayer. It is obvious that bankers are not falling over one another to make the money available. The amount needed, even before production of commercial models begins, is at least $5 billion. The risk is that it could be double or triple the estimates. This has been the pattern during the development of the Concorde, the British and French supersonic. Because it is so unpredictably open-end, one French critic has described the SST as an industrial Vietnam. Nevertheless, to accommodate the president, the Wall Street banks approached by the Nixon administration might offer a short-term loan. This would keep the project alive long enough for the administration to organize an alternate form of financing. This might be a government-sponsored independent corporation. People with confidence in the SST could buy stock in the corporation, just as they once did for communication satellites. There is talk that foreign interests might buy the two unfinished prototypes and 22 engines and other assets. The U.S. has spent almost $1 billion to bring the project to this point. It's been suggested it might sell the results for a penny on the dollar. So it would be a bargain if anyone is interested. SST workers are being released by Boeing and General Electric, but the Nixon administration is unwilling to accept the patient's death. It could be revived at some future time, even if at considerable expense. The United States once put a Navy fleet into mothballs and might do the same with a couple of unfinished and currently unwanted SSTs. Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Washington.
We edited the statement of one of those traveling colonels. We were supposed to have left out the fact that he quoted Savannah Fuma. I've examined the transcript of the colonel's statement, and it is difficult to tell where Savannah Fuma left off and the colonel started. At any rate, when we checked back to the original magazine source, we found that the colonel was paraphrasing this statement from Savannah Fuma in U.S. News and World Report, November 6, 1967. Should South Vietnam become communist, that is to say, should all of Vietnam become communist, it would be difficult for Laos to exist. The same goes for Cambodia, the same for other countries. The colonel lifted that statement to make a Pentagon point. He embraced it and simply used Savannah Fuma as his authority. But the print said something else the colonel omitted. In that same interview, Savannah Fuma gave a warning about going into Laos, which the colonel did not quote. We are all seeking a limit to the conflict. Therefore, from a military point of view, this barrier would not be effective. And from the political view, on the international scene, the barrier would not only extend to conflict into Laos, but perhaps even to Thailand. In other words, the colonel relied on the prince when it suited him and left out that part which did not suit him. To pass on to another point, Mr. Agnew cites us for financing a secret and illegal invasion to overthrow Haiti. He alleges we came dangerously close to illegal activities. The answers are quite simple. We did not finance the planned invasion. We did nothing illegal. No significant amount of money, even inadvertently, found its way to persons involved in the invasion plan. The Department of Justice found no unlawful activities on the part of CBS News. And John Davitt, chief of the criminal division of the U.S. Department of Justice, said, quote, CBS advised us of the facts, advised the Bureau of Customs that they were there and that they were filming these episodes. At one point, the Treasury Department asked us not to withdraw from the project. But the short answer to the vice president is that he is attacking a journalistic investigation that never became a broadcast about an invasion that never took place. The vice president also referred to a broadcast of 3 years ago, Hunger in America. He has repeated the charge that a baby we said died of malnutrition did not die of this disease. We have checked and rechecked this fact. At the time, we were told by a hospital official that the baby did die of hunger. Later, after the broadcast, she changed the story somewhat and new evidence came to light. There is no way, however, for the fact to be proven or disproven with certainty at this point. But in that area, at that time, and in that hospital, babies were dying of malnutrition. And the irony of the vice president's blast is that President Nixon said of hunger in America that it, quote, really aroused Americans for the first time that in this rich land there is hunger. Finally, let me sum up briefly our position regarding all these charges against CBS News. We can refute every charge made by the gentleman you saw a few minutes ago. We are proud of the selling of the Pentagon, and CBS News stands behind it.
Then I got all those damn little parcels.
Yeah.
And when you get finished, I'm paying over $3,000 on just this land alone.
Golly. And some you don't own.
Well, I got that straight.
Oh, you got that all right?
Yeah. But I tell you, I'm just going to have to file suit against them because I don't even have a fancy building or paved road on the place.
Hmm. Golly. Jeez.
So I'm going to try to get with George Rao and then go talk to Port-au-Prince and see what I can come up with.
Hmm. Well, did you get your rider straightened out?
Yeah. Yeah, I got him straight.
Well,
listen, I certainly do thank you for the invitation, but I won't be able to make it today.
Yeah?
Because I probably won't even get anything but grab a cracker or something.
We'll take a rain check.
Okay, good.
Very good.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Then we will have the kind of information which will justify our telling the French and the British and the Russians that their aircraft is not welcome on our soil, and further, to enable us to lead a convincing, plausible fight for a worldwide treaty banning the SST.
Senator, were you going to vote for the SST before you went to the White House yesterday?
Yes.
Was there anything that the president said to you yesterday that further reinforced your position or that you found took care of any omissions in your own thinking?
Let's put it this way. I had one concern as of the time I went to the House, White House, and that was this concern over the momentum factor that many people have feared, and I think the fear is a reasonable one, that if we had invested this amount of money and had gotten a prototype which had proven itself, the impulse to go forward might be so strong that the environmental factors would be a little bit lost sight of, or there'd be some chance-taking, and we can't afford to take chances. So I wanted to hear the president say what had been said on his behalf by Secretary Volpe and by Russell Train, that he was serious and seriously committed to the proposition that all of the data which will be accumulated as a result of a $26 million testing program will be scrutinized from the environmentalist point of view, and that no work would be undertaken to put this into commercial use until there was a clean bill of health. This he did, and further, he advised me that he intended to set up a committee now, or a mechanism now, to scrutinize this evidence so that the public would be aware of the fact of the seriousness of this commitment.
Senator, do you feel that you've disappointed many people in the state of New York who voted for you by now voting for the SST?
I'm afraid that I will, and this frankly made this the most difficult decision for me because people have a tendency to look at the headline and then not look at the reasons which have guided me in reaching the decision I made.
Senator, do you find yourself in a rather contradictory, perhaps embarrassing position because of your yes vote on the SST? You are an environmentalist, and there has been no proof that the SST will not damage the environment. and you are a conservative, and yet you're looking toward federal funding rather than private enterprise to help finance the development of the SST.
Let's take these things one at a time. I am not at all embarrassed about the decision from the environmentalist point of view, because a prototype can't damage anything. What can do damage is having 300 or 400 planes constantly in the air, emitting the water vapor and the carbon dioxide and so on into the upper atmosphere, where the mechanics of cleansing is quite different from the mechanics in the lower atmosphere. As far as federal funding is concerned, there are certain projects that are simply too large, which involve too great a risk-taking for the for private enterprise to handle. And I'd like to point out, for example, that our railroad system, our transcontinental railroad system, 100-some-odd years ago, was launched as a result of a federal program. Now, this subsidy, incidentally, is a loan which is reimbursable, and in point of fact, the federal government, if this thing works, could make a profit out of it. Secondly, we must remember that our other post-war commercial aircraft have been fallouts from military developments.
Senator, at this particular point, which side do you think will win the voting this afternoon at 4?
It will be close. I just have no idea.
Senator, on the economic argument, one of the effective arguments in the House, which reversed the House's position, as you know, was who needs it. That this is really a help for the few who can afford to pay the higher fare to shave a couple of hours off a trip to Paris at the expense of maybe mass transportation and the people who maybe take a couple of hours to get across Manhattan on bad days. Does that bother you?
Not too much. One of the problems, both from the environmental point of view and the economic point of view, is that our decision with respect to our SST program will not stop others from going forward with theirs, both to the possible detriment of the environment and to the possible cost of American jobs. Now, this is an industry where America has been in the forefront of world development for a number of years. The number of people involved are not necessarily the people who are flying, but the 150,000 some odd jobs that are directly involved or through subcontractors, the tremendous amount of taxes that are paid as a result of this complex of production, which in turn helps finance other federal programs. No, I think this is a complex problem, but I don't believe that the net cost is going to be such as to keep us from doing what we ought to be doing in other spheres.
Senator Buckley, you're arguing that the prototype should be built to test out whether there's any danger to the environment.
Right.
Yet one of your colleagues, Senator Proxmire, says the prototypes will not provide those answers. And there are those who say, why not let research rather than prototypes check out the environmental hazards?
Two reasons. First of all, I would respectfully disagree with Senator Proxmire. I've talked to scientists, my staff and I have talked to people on both sides of the equation, and there seem to be a consensus that this kind of information would provide the data on which a decision could be made. And secondly, that there was a strong feeling that laboratory work itself could not really give the hard answers as to what actually happens way up there in the stratosphere under operating conditions, both in terms of the interaction of water vapor on ozone, in terms of determining the particulate size of the emissions from the engines and things of that sort. The kind of hard evidence which was required if you're going to be convincing and telling foreign governments they've got to stop theirs. And I think this is something that's lost sight of. We are not going to save the environment by grounding our SSTs. We can only do it if we have the datum which is convincingly enough to appeal to the world community.
Thank you very much, Senator James Buckley, conservative Republican from New York. John?
Thanks, gentlemen. Catching up on the rest of the news, the South Vietnamese are out of Laos now, Saigon saying the operation there accomplished 80% to 90% of its objectives. The Laotians sent 3 battalions of reinforcements to their royal capital of Luang Prabang and pushed the communists away from the city. A Seattle grand jury indicted Joseph Alioto, mayor of San Francisco, charging him with bribery, conspiracy, and mail fraud.
It's now 11 minutes before the hour.
Hubert, time to go.
Wait, ma'am. Pat made coffee.
Junior, you know I love Pat, but she can't make coffee like Mother can.
She found a better coffee.
Coffee, anyone?
Yuck.
I found a better coffee. Instant.
Folgers coffee crystals. Folgers is darker and richer than this regular.